This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The British director Mike Leigh is best known in the States for his films Secrets and Lies and Topsy Turvy, which was about Gilbert and Sullivan. His new film, Vera Drake, is set in England in 1950, when the country is still recovering from the war. Vera Drake lives with her husband and two grown children in a small flat. Her husband is an auto mechanic. She cleans houses for a living. But she secretly performs abortions. Not for money, she never takes any. She sees her job as helping women who have no other option. But Vera Drake is not medically trained, and her technique is primitive and unsanitary. After a woman nearly dies from an infection, the police find out about Drake. She's shattered by the news of the woman's infection and by the impact her no longer secret work will have on her family. In this scene, she's getting questioned by a detective inspector. Vera Drake is played by Imelda Staunton.
Can you answer my question, please? How do you help them out?
When they can't manage.
When they can't manage.
That's right.
You mean when they're pregnant? So, how do you help them out?
I help them start their bleeding again.
You help them to get rid of the baby. You perform an abortion. Is that right, Mrs. Drake? You perform abortions, don't you?
That's not what I do, dear. That's what you call it, but they need help. Who else they going to turn to? They got no one. I help them out.
Just to set the scene for us, can you tell us what the law about abortion is in England now and what it was in 1950 when your movie's set?
Well, the law was changed in England and Wales in 1967. Before that, abortion, as in many places in the world then and now, was outlawed. There were exceptional circumstances in which abortions could take place, and that is dealt with in a subplot in the film, in Vera Drake. When the film is set in 1950, it was simply, on the whole, a matter that was dealt with by illegal, illicit backstreet abortionists, and that's what the film is concerned with.
Now, there are a lot of back alley abortionists who are opportunists, who preyed on women with no options, but that's not Vera Drake, your main character. She's the kind of woman who helps her neighbors. She takes care of her family. She always has a tea kettle on. She comforts other people, and she performs abortions because she empathizes with the women who she feels, for whatever reason, can't have this child. She feels they have no one to turn to, and she can help them by providing an abortion, a word that she won't even use. She says, "I help young girls out." Would you describe how she performs the abortion?
Well, I mean, she simply injects an alien fluid into the uterus, and that causes a miscarriage. But I think the point about her approach to it and the kind of woman that she is and represents is that in all societies, at all times, there have always been Vera Drakes, women who, you know, whether they're in your family or in the next street or the next block or the next village or the next town, who were there who knew how to deal with this problem. And she's one of those, basically. And she doesn't do it for money. She does it, as you say, because she thinks that it's important to help people.
Now, you said she injects a substance into the uterus, inducing an abortion, but it's kind of horrifying when you see what she's doing because, you know, she's not a medical professional, and she uses a very kind of primitive, unsanitary means of providing these abortions. And because she doesn't make follow-up visits, she is not aware of the infections that sometimes set in.
I think she's aware of the risk. And in fact, she knows that she's using a disinfectant. And she actually doesn't know whether she has previously caused infections, as ultimately happens during the story of the film. But the important thing is, I mean, the general implication of the whole thing is that indeed if, for example, in the States, the law were to be changed, as is being discussed, the legislation, and if you were to go back to a situation where abortion was outlawed, then amateurs would be back on the scene doing what Vera Drake does. And it's for listeners to decide whether they think that is acceptable or not, really.
Throughout the movie, there's no speeches. Nobody makes a speech about whether abortion is right or wrong, no matter what the context is, no matter what the scene is. And I was greatly relieved by that, not so much because of the issue of abortion, but because I just hate those kinds of speeches in movies where suddenly somebody who isn't very articulate or talkative is eloquent, and they make this speech, and the audience is basically supposed to, like, rise and cheer on their behalf. You managed to get through this whole movie without any of that.
Well, I mean, I make films, and this is by no means the first such film that I've made, which are very much character-driven. I mean, my job is to create absolutely believable three-dimensional characters, and that's what I hope has happened in this film. And what I also am committed to do is to make films that confront the audience with questions rather than lay on the line simplistic black-and-white polemic. And so here I'm disposed to raise questions and confront the audience with the moral dilemma that this whole issue is about. And so, you know, here is a very good woman who is undoubtedly motivated by very positive desires to help other people, but who we have to look at in the role of a criminal because of the laws of society. And it's up to the audience, really, to make those speeches, if you like, which you very properly say the film don't happen within the film. There is a point in the film where there is a bit of argument about the whole issue when the son is horrified by what's happened, having discovered what his mother has been doing over the years. And there's just a moment when she does actually come out and make a very quiet, simple statement about why she does it. But you're absolutely right. There's no scope for these characters who would otherwise be inarticulate to stand up and convert themselves, metamorphose themselves into Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird.
The film is dedicated in loving memory of your parents, a doctor and midwife. So your mother was a midwife and your father was a doctor?
Yes, my mother had been a midwife long ago and really stopped doing it before I was born. But my father was a doctor and was an ordinary general practitioner in a working class practice in Manchester. And indeed, until I was 13, we lived over the shop, so to speak. I would love to have talked to him last year when we were making Vera Drake about his related experiences, just, you know, as an ordinary doctor with a working class practice, just dealing with, you know, women that wanted to terminate their pregnancies or indeed abortions that had gone wrong and related things. I couldn't because he died in 1985, and so I put that little memory to them on the end of the film.
Now, you are well known for your improvisational technique in making movies. And my understanding is you only tell the actors what they need to know for that part of the movie. So in other words, an actor in one of your films wouldn't know all the twists and turns of their fate. They would just know the opening scene or the opening few scenes. And then as the movie goes on, they find out what happens to them. Is that an accurate description?
No, it is not quite accurate. I mean, the principle of it's generally right, but in fact, what it really is that no actor in my films ever knows any more than his or her character would know. That's the point.
I see. Okay.
And that's and we rehearse for 6 months, as we did for this film, before we shoot anything, and during that time we create the raw material out of which we, having done that, we then shoot the picture in a very formal and classical way. So what we shoot is very, very thoroughly rehearsed and precise. So the first take and the 13th take are exactly the same material. The surprise isn't in the first take on camera, it's some months previously during the rehearsals.
When you're casting actors, do you usually look for actors who you are confident will have improvisational gifts and will be able to add through improvisation to the character's development?
Absolutely. The sort of actors that I like to work with are actors who are intelligent and have a social sense and have a sense of humour and a sense of people and are character actors. And by that I don't mean that in the Hollywood sense of once gorgeous people who are relegated to the rank of playing grotesque cameos. But by character actors I mean people who are versatile and can play all sorts of different people and get inside their skins and can work together in a, also actors who can work together in an ensemble, and I look for those kind of actors, and we're blessed here with great actors in England, and those are the actors that I try and get in these films.
Now, unless you've already worked with an actor, how do you know if they have those gifts?
Well, you develop instincts and ways of auditioning and finding out, which I'm not going to tell you because they're a trade secret. I mean, I hadn't worked with Imelda Staunton before, actually, but I know her work and I know her a bit. I've known her over the years, and I've sensed that she would be very good indeed in this film, and it turns out I was right. She's wonderful.
Is there something specific within a scene that dialogue or a twist of the character's fate that she came up with that you could describe?
Well, the whole performance consists of a growth of the character, and indeed, there is, without spoiling it for people that haven't seen it, I mean, you know, when you see the film, there's a moment when, you know, they come to arrest her, and you see her going through, you see her whole world collapsing in one continuous series of moments. I hold on her face, and you just see everything changing, and that's an amazing piece of acting, which comes completely out of the organic improvisation and investigation that we did in order to arrive at the material.
Since you brought it up, you know, she is arrested in the movie, and some of the reviews express their disappointment that this character emotionally collapses and kind of gives in to the authorities. She shows no spine after she's arrested, and I have to say I didn't see it that way at all, and it seems to me...
No, I mean, I think that's an eccentric and rather kind of ivory tower sort of view of things. I mean, that really comes from people who, for whom every movie has to be a kind of fake celebration of human dignity in a completely implausible and Hollywood kind of way. I mean, this film, Vera Drake, you know, looks at something that inevitably happens to somebody as a result of the way society is. And indeed, what's important is that the audience, when, you know, when they share her journey with her, they feel what she feels and go where she goes without having to be let off the hook by simple fake devices.
My guest is British film director Mike Lee. His new movie is called Vera Drake. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British film director Mike Lee. His movies include Secrets and Lies and Topsy Turvy. His new film, Vera Drake, is set in 1950. It's about a working-class woman who secretly performs illegal abortions. The movie's set in 1950, and there's still a black market for goods in England, goods that remain scarce in the post-war years, like tea and sugar. You were born in 1943, so you came of age. I mean, you were growing up in this era. What are some of your memories of post-war England and some of the shortages, some of the difficulties that faced families?
Well, when I was a kid at school, at Christmas, there'd always be a Christmas party at which Santa Claus would come. It was always a teacher dressed up in a white beard. But in order that Santa could give out sweeties, candy, to the kids, we had to bring in our sweetie coupons, that's to say the coupons that the Ministry of Food supplied in order that sweets could be bought, so that they could go and buy sweets, candy, for Santa Claus to give out. I mean, that's one of my memories. That world was a world of utility, you know. There was a kind of drabness and it was a world in which, certainly up until the beginning of the 50s, not very many things were new. I mean, most of the things around in the house, in the street, even the things that grown-ups wore, dated back to before World War II. I mean, things hadn't been replaced. It was a very grey atmosphere, although it was a very warm atmosphere because people were putting their lives together after the trauma of the Second World War. And indeed, that spirit is something that I've tried to capture in Vera Drake.
How were your parents' lives affected by the war?
Well, my father qualified as a doctor in 1939, but he never got to be a regular doctor till 1940. 47 because the war intervened, and for most of the war, he was away. Some of the British army was he was an army doctor, and he happened to be in southern Africa for most of the time because they had troops down there training Africans to go and fight in Europe. You know, and he was he spent a lot of time in army camps in Africa, and so my parents didn't see each other. And this, of course, was the fate of millions of people all around the world. And of course, it's when you think about it, that's quite something. I mean, he managed to get back twice, to pay two visits, resulting in myself and my younger sister. I mean, you know, it's tough. And then after the war, they had to put their lives back together again.
How aware were you of that when you were growing up?
Oh, very. The expression before the war, during the war, and after the war was an expression that you heard grown-ups using all the time. Oh, you were totally... And also, I mean, Manchester, which is where I grew up, was very severely hit in the Blitz by the Germans. And so, you know, one grew up surrounded by collapsed buildings and bomb sites. And so one was very aware of it.
So you grew up in Manchester, and in your early years you lived above your father's medical office. What was it like being the son of the family doctor in a working-class city?
Well, it meant that I was one of the few middle-class kids in a working-class school. There was no particular significance to it. I mean, the main thing about living over the practice, the surgery, as we would call it in England, was that, there was it's a very heavy industrial area, and in those days, before the Clean Air legislation, there was very thick black smog on the air, you know, that was affecting people's breathing. And so I would remember coming home from school and going through into the house via the waiting room, which would be full of mostly men, just you know, just a chorus of that going on. It was some sort of the music of my childhood.
Well, what movies did you identify with growing up? Did you gravitate toward, you know, more kitchen sink kind of movies, realist movies?
Well, there weren't any when I was growing up until the very end of the 50s,
mm-hmm.
At which point that happened to be when I came to London and discovered world cinema. And that was the time of the British New Wave. But the British New Wave, for me, wasn't half as exciting as the Nouvelle Vague, the French New Wave. And as I say, I discovered world cinema then, because when I was a kid growing up, you could see all kinds of movies, but they were all American or British movies. And so there was an endless diet of, you know, Hollywood and British war movies and British comedies and westerns and all the rest of it.
Which were the ones that you loved and that made you think, boy, if I'm really lucky, I'll do this one day?
Well, I was a sucker, and indeed I still am, for all kinds of movies. I mean, I went to the pictures, as we called it, to the movies, as often as they would let you. And but the moment which crystallised for me the notion of being a filmmaker was actually when I was 12, when my paternal grandfather died. It was a very snowy day in December 1955, and there was thick snow on the ground, and we were all gathered together in the little house, and these old guys struggled down the stairs with drips at the end of their noses with the coffin. And I just remember looking around and thinking, wow, this would make a fantastic film. And then thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to make films.
Mike Lee directed the new film Vera Drake.